Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags, and over the next 30 minutes I'll bring you the latest headlines from South Africa and around the globe. Whether you're tuning in live or catching the podcast later, please stay with us for in-depth conversation with leading business minds, political influencers and key newsmakers. It's everything you need to stay informed, quick, sharp and straight to the point. It's Monday, the 21st of October on our program today. What to expect from the upcoming midterm budget announcement? Are financial institutions in developing economies keeping up with digital transformation? Will sending in the defense force to deal with the so-called construction mafia solve the problem? And is there any light at the end of the tunnel for South Africa's automotive sector? As we look ahead to the Finance Minister Enoch Godongwana's medium-term budget policy statement on the 30th of October, the stakes could not be higher. South Africa's coalition government is under pressure to manage rising debt, stagnant reforms, and a looming economic crisis. The markets, of course, are watching closely, and so is the public, to see if the minister can pull off a balancing act between austerity and growth. Joining us now is Martin Ackerman, chief economist at Citadel. And Martin, with so much riding on this speech, what do you think the most urgent challenge is that the minister has to address?
Yes, I think, you know, we need to keep in mind that the medium-term budget is always just an update where we are. Typically, we don't see any policy decisions or tax decisions there. They can do it, but it's more an update. And I think if you compare to where we are now versus where we've been in February, you know, just a lot of things change. Mm. And the government of national unity and the positive sentiment and South African asset classes and the rand and all of that. So I think that is definitely something we can talk about the detail there, but there's definitely some tailwinds that they can put into the budget that will make the picture look much better. But there's two things I think that is going to be still a bit of a challenge. You know, the wage bill is still a big part of the budget, and they started wage negotiations. You know, the 12% government went back to 3%. So depending on where they settle there, that can have a huge impact on the expense side. And the other thing is, you know, in those numbers, we'll remember we spoke a lot about the gold and foreign exchange reserves in February. Mm. So about 100 billion of that is now in the numbers, so that will make it look much better. But that ability to tap into the count is also now reducing because with a stronger rand, the actual value is less. So it will need to be a balancing act in terms of, you know, still the expense side of the equation, and then, you know, not really in a position to just keep on borrowing. Until we can get the economy going to actually increase tax revenue and replace the borrowing requirement.
You talk about those positive tailwinds, and that is a good thing. But I'd also suggest to you, Martin, the clock is ticking very loudly, because while the markets have reacted positively to the formation of this GNU or coalition government, if we don't see real fiscal reform, that optimism is going to dissipate.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. If we don't see real numbers on the table, well, call it early next year, that sentiment is definitely going to disappear. Our deputy minister recently in the UK, and also deputy president and President Ramaphosa yesterday himself as well, you know, they're talking about growth for next year around about 3%. That's their target. They set some things in motion to get there. And I think, you know, that is their view. We're probably going to see those kind of assumptions in the budget at the end of October. Now, keep in mind, in February, the view for next year was about 1.7. So if they plug in a 3% number for next year, you know, all of the metrics relative to GDP is going to look much better. But you're 100% right. So that, you know, that's just looking forward on expected growth. if we don't get those numbers, then in reality, going into next year, you know, the reality is we're in a very tight corner still in terms of balancing our expenses and our revenue.
Notwithstanding the wage bill that you've already mentioned, cutting spending is obviously a key focus. Where can the minister realistically make cuts without crippling essential services?
Yeah, I guess that is where they always talk about pulling a rabbit out of the hat.
Yeah.
Because, you know, many of those services and expenses are almost baked into the cake. If you think about things like the social grants, you know, we can't move away from that. That will be devastating, not only to the people receiving that, but, you know, in terms of stability in the country. So there's not a lot that they can do there, which brings us back to the wage bill. So if you think about the budget, you know, why do we talk a lot about debt? Because 20% of the budget is already being paid for interest service. So you're only left with 80% of the budget to spend elsewhere. Then you add the wage bill, it takes the rest of the budget, probably 60%. And then you've got the rest that you can spend on healthcare, education, social grants, and. And that is why the focus is very much on trying to get debt under control, but also address the wage bill. Our wage bill as a percentage of GDP is the highest in the OECD countries. And that's probably where, and they've done it in the past, is to say, well, what is the plan addressing that? It is things like not replacing people when they retire, not creating new job opportunities, and then in time trying to have below inflation increases. And that is why the current negotiations are going to be so important in terms of where they settle with that, because that will then be in the pipeline for the next 3 years.
Martin, you'd have sympathy for that rabbit if it didn't want to come out of the hat, because unless the minister can assure or reassure the international lending community that South Africa is serious about debt reduction, we're just going to be spinning our tires here.
Yes, I think, you know, if the economy is not getting anywhere, so there's still a lot of pressure on the tax revenue side. The only alternative is in the debt markets. And the concern already, you know, now we're going back since COVID when we've been downgraded to sub-investment grade, where markets are saying, but this is not sustainable. You need to get into a fiscal discipline, which they are very much committed to, and they are making some progress. But we need to start showing them that you're moving away from that, what they call the fiscal cliff or the debt spiral. Because the risk is that if you keep on borrowing, and by the way, we'll probably be able to do that, because if you look at our real interest rates, there's a lot of foreigners willing to lend us the money. But that interest component in the budget goes in from 20% to 25% to 30%. And that's really where you run into a huge risk that's, you know, somewhere down the line, a government in that kind of position can default on the debt. And that's the last thing we want to do.
So the left of the political spectrum, Martin, is pushing for a fiscal stimulus, which it says will ignite job creation. But as you've pointed out, we have limited funds. So is there a realistic way that the minister can pursue this without increasing debt?
Unfortunately not. And that's why I do think the silver bullet is exactly what I spoke about, the president himself addressing some of the issues that's low-hanging issues that's preventing us to get to faster growth. We know the issues there. It's like the logistical network is probably top of mind right now. It's much easier or quicker, rather, to try and fix that and let the economy, through economic growth, fix a couple of things. Give you more money in your pocket in terms of, for government in terms of tax collection. Don't need to increase the tax rate. It's just more activity, more tax. And then an economy growing at 3% will certainly create jobs as well. And that immediately takes the pressure off government to actually have a fiscal project to try and create jobs. To be honest, it's not the job of the government or the deliverable for government to create jobs. That is business, private sector that needs to do that. But then you need to have an economy that is growing with the right incentives and logistical and electric, water, all those kind of infrastructure that support that growth going forward.
Well, it is a big day on the political and the economic calendar, October the 30th. Martin Ackerman, Chief Economist at Citadel, thank you so much for talking to me.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Are financial institutions in developing countries keeping up with digital transformation? The whole concept is reshaping the financial landscape, particularly in developing economies, with fintech driving financial inclusion and institutions facing global economic challenges. So are we navigating the shifts in this part of the world? It's crucial, I would suggest, for staying competitive. Joining us now is David Parker, Global Chair of Financial Services at Accenture. And David, given the rapid pace of change, are financial services firms then in developing economies truly prepared to harness the potential of transformation, or are we falling behind, should I say, in addressing the critical gaps?
I think that, you know, if you look at the progress over the last, you know, 10 or 15 years, it's actually incredible what has been achieved. And, you know, it's incredible in terms of the availability of digital services, whether it's, you know, digital banking or whether it's mobile money or whether it's, you know, access to lending platforms, you know, buy now, pay later, you know, all sorts of different, you know, capabilities that barely existed 10 years ago. And I think the results, you know, I'm pretty sure even, you know, especially in South Africa, you know, speak for themselves, right? In terms of, you know, 84% of adults, I think now, you know, have formal financial products, you know, which is up from 50%, you know, only 10 years ago. So I think a lot has been achieved, but, you know, we're at a, I think a real pivot point right now, which is as we're starting to see the adoption of AI at scale and at pace internationally. And, you know, I do think that there is therefore enormous opportunity for, you know, banks in emerging markets and developing markets and South Africa, you know, to really exploit that. And, you know, certainly here this week, seen some great examples of kind of where that's starting to happen. But I think there's a long way to go.
Well, let's talk about that, a long way to go. How do you think we can accelerate capitalizing on the opportunity that you've just outlined?
Well, I think anything that relates to AI has to start with the data. AI without data is meaningless, and therefore, you know, any institution that wants to take advantage of the power of AI has to be able to have its data, you know, in a an effective format. It needs to understand, you know, its history, where the data came from, you know, and, you know, whether it is accurate and deduplicated, and, you know, whether it's linking in particular, you know, its customers together. So it's not, you know, product data, it's customer data. So I think that's a really important, you know, first step. I think the second, you know, critical step is you have to have the talent and the workforce that is sort of able to, you know, really exploit the power of AI. And unlike previous technologies, you know, there's really two types of talent. So you absolutely, you need the heavy techies, you need the people who, you know, understand how to configure AI safely, responsibly, and in an integrated way with your data. But the most important, you know, skill, more than anything else, to really exploit the value from AI is actually language. Because, you know, generative AI in particular, you know, is a language-driven technology. And therefore, you know, what we're seeing is, you know, particularly in some of the larger markets in North America and in Europe, is a race to democratize access to AI, you know, giving it to everybody so that, you know, the harnessing of the power of it, you know, the introduction of new innovation isn't something that comes out of an AI department or a tech department. It's something that everybody is doing, you know, whether you're in customer service, whether you're in, you know, credit, whether you're in compliance, whether you're a relationship manager, you know, everybody, when they have access to AI, can figure out actually how to use it and how to bring advantage, you know, to themselves and their customers.
And David, let me suggest to you that the argument makes perfect sense, but I would come right back at you and say that every single market around the world is facing this problem, and there is becoming, and particularly in developing economies, there's a real challenge in competing for those skills that are so necessary to harness the potential of AI.
Yeah, I think that's right, and absolutely, you know, there's a war for talent, if we want to put it that way, for, you know, particularly the most technical skills. But actually, like any technology, you know, as AI becomes more ingrained, more partners within the ecosystem are able to sort of build on top of the raw engineering, and they're able to extract people or customers from having to really understand that. So already we're seeing it, large language models are able to create significant levels of insight on their own before you start training them on your own data. And one of the ideas that we're starting to see get real traction is the idea of what we would call an agentic AI architecture, which is multiple agents who are capable of dealing with individual tasks, whether it's helping a relationship manager summarize a meeting or helping an underwriter understand all the information that's been submitted to them. Those agents, increasingly, you can start to acquire pre-configured versions of those agents. So if you think about it, it's in some ways it's like acquiring or hiring someone into your team that's already experienced. So I think things like agentic architecture will really accelerate the adoption of AI without needing the really hardcore AI developers on the actual models.
Let me ask you one final question, and we haven't touched on this. You talk about the increasing importance of data, all well and good, but the role of data security and privacy is an issue first and foremost in the transformation of financial services. Are we paying enough attention to that, and what are your concerns within that sphere?
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely critical, right? I mean, without trust, and trust and security around your data and around your money, financial services doesn't exist as an industry. And so it has to be at the foundation of any responsible company. With that said, companies are getting a lot better at it. We're all seeing them invest heavily in cyber protection. We're all seeing them invest to build responsible AI frameworks and policies to make sure they're using the data in an appropriate and fair way. I do think, particularly when it comes to financial crime, there's a lot more work that needs to be done. The fact that the Financial Action Task Force, put South Africa on the grey list in 2023, does really point to that there is, more action that is needed in that space. But we certainly, from an Accenture perspective, we see lots of activity in that space and a recognition of how important it is.
Visiting South Africa, David Parker, Global Chair of Financial Services at Accenture. I do appreciate your time. Thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The so-called construction mafia continues to extort business, disrupting projects and causing billions in losses. With the situation escalating, there's now talk of deploying the Defence Force to assist in tackling the issue. But is that really the solution, and how did we get there in the first place? When we spoke earlier to the Public Works Minister, he said it was not in his purview, but pointed out that similar deployment had worked for Eskom. MoneyWeb writer Roy Cocaine is with me now. He's been working the story for some time. And Roy, calling in the Defence Force, I would suggest, signals just how bad the construction mafia situation has become. How did we reach this point, and why has it been allowed to escalate?
I don't know why it's been allowed to escalate, because it's been a problem for many, many years. And there have been complaints by the construction industry. And you've even had President Cyril Ramaphosa in his State of the Nation address in February 2022. Saying that there would be special police units to deal with this issue. But that hasn't led to an improvement. I think part of the problem is that when there is any action that's going to be taken against the construction mafia, from what I've been told, there hasn't been any interaction and engagement with construction industry organizations. I think that they're vital to be part of it. They are stakeholders, and their members are stakeholders, and they've got a vested interest. So it's important that that is discussed with them, so they've got insights that other people won't have.
Roy, is it difficult to determine the root cause of the problem? Is it purely just organized crime, or are there deeper, maybe systemic issues within the construction industry that have been ignored?
Well, it's moved from the construction industry to other sectors. They spoke about sort of extortionate spas, shops that I've read about, and that sort of thing. So it's not limited to construction. I think it's something that has come about as a result of maybe hardship and the tough financial times, economic times, and people are looking for some way to sustain themselves. Obviously, there would be some element of greed, but this isn't really an issue about small and medium construction, black-owned construction businesses that are not getting a stake in the industry. As McPherson said, that those are the ones that are actually the biggest losers. And you know, most of the, from what I've, large construction companies I've spoken to, they have a lot of engagement with community. So the construction mafia problems they're picking up, they're not from necessarily from the community. They're from other people that come from outside and they sideline the community, people that want to be involved.
Roy, have you tested, when you've spoken to these construction companies, the appetite for bringing in the military? I mean, you'll agree with me that it might create a heavy-handed approach and that could even escalate tension further.
I have to admit, I haven't actually spoken to them about this yet. But what I must caution here is that in Dean McPherson's statement, he didn't say that they must bring in the military. He said that this matter has been dealt with before, and he referred to ESCOM and how they brought in the Defence Force to stop the sabotage, and it worked. And so, and he spoke in terms of having this the summit, and obviously that will be one of the things on the table. And if that summit does include construction industry organisations, then obviously they can have their input there as well and say whether they think that is a desirable route or not.
Whatever the solution is, it's vital that one is reached quickly, because the construction industry, and again, I understand that it's spread to other sectors as well, but specifically the construction industry, vital to the country's economy. And Roy, this is having an impact on jobs, investor confidence, and overall economic growth. These companies must be concerned.
No, they have been concerned for quite some time. They've found a way to sort of work around it, but they still have disruptions and there's still incidents. You know, whenever they release financial results and I speak to CEOs, they talk that there are still issues with this. Some of them also aren't that as open as they might, and I don't think they're as candid as they might be about the problems that they've got, because they don't want to draw attention to themselves. You know, and that's something that has been highlighted by Master Builder South Africa, where they felt that companies weren't reporting openly and honestly to them because they thought that if they did, and they would be targeted even more.
One of the impacts, of course, Roy, and again, I don't know how much you know about this, but even reports of construction projects being abandoned due to these extortion demands. Critical that whatever the solution is, more is done to protect businesses and specifically workers who are on site right now.
Oh, most definitely. You know, you've the construction sector is seen as a very, very important employment creator, and that is well known. And post, just after the COVID hard lockdown, you would have recalled President Ramaphosa spoke about the role that the construction industry can create jobs and help people to actually lift themselves out of the situation that they were placed in with COVID and not having sufficient food or things like that, which is possibly, as I said, a driving force. But I think that with the construction market and where the way it's organized, it's much bigger than that.
And Roy, just finally, again, going back to what Minister McPherson said, obviously not his call as far as the Defence Force is concerned. That would be something that has to come from the presidency. But you'll agree that calling in the Defence Force, if it happens, cannot become just a temporary fix. There have got to be long-term strategies in place to dismantle these networks.
Well, most definitely. And there also, there needs to be, you have to take away the confusion that has been created and is being used to justify the actions of the construction mafia. And here I refer to the 30% so-called set aside on projects for small, medium and black-owned businesses. And McPherson actually referred to that specifically, you know, and he said that the government has done what the government has done unknowingly is that they've monetized and incentivized the acts of criminality, violence, and murder. to the detriment of small and medium black-sized companies.
Let's see what happens at that summit. MoneyWeb writer Roy Kokain, thank you very much indeed. I appreciate it.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And finally, as South Africa's automotive market faces economic pressure, used vehicle demand remains strong and, interestingly, a growing interest in electric vehicles. All of this is reshaping the landscape. So even with the recent dip in interest rates and challenges in vehicle financing, many consumers are finding alternative ways of navigating these obstacles. I'm joined now by Marcia Mayaba, who is Vice President of the Auto Information Services at TransUnion. And Marcia, first of all, then the local automotive market has seen a significant decline in new vehicle sales. It really is on the back foot. Do you see any hope of recovery?
Jeremy, the way you've level set in your opening, I think you have absolutely given relevant remarks about the state of our automotive industry. So where are we? Today, TransUnion released our vehicle price index report, and indeed, it does talk about a decline year on year of new vehicle sales of approximately 6%, this time 2023 relative to now. And at the same time, we are definitely seeing an improvement, as you said earlier, on the preference of consumers towards pre-owned vehicle sales. However, this report that we are sharing, I've shared today, is focused on quarter two 2024. And I think to your point, Jeremy, the latter part of 2024 is really giving us some optimism. Why do I say so? Recent events like the 0.25 basis point interest rate reduction a few weeks ago is a green shoot for us. Reduced fuel prices is a green shoot. Improved power supply. So between ourselves and the automotive industry, we are really optimistic about the latter part of this year when it comes to the automotive industry and vehicle sales.
Marcia, when you look at the sales generally, particularly in the new car segment, is there a particular category within that segment that is most under pressure? In other words, mid-range, top of the market, or entry level?
I think the spread is across, Jeremy. The segments are all taking strain. The interesting thing, for the first time in a long time, we have seen in September passenger vehicles increasing by 2% compared to this time last year, which hardly ever happens. So every segment, the LCV market, the medium and heavy commercial truck market, the extra heavy market, which is very buoyant, you know, we're not seeing any uptick really from there. So the market is very subdued at the moment, Jeremy.
And if interest rates continue to come down, hopefully we'll see more of those green shoots, as you referred to it as.
Absolutely. And what I didn't mention earlier, the premium segment is really, really taking a beating in the last few months. In fact, for the whole of 2024, I think the one that is impacted the most is the premium vehicle segment market, Jeremy.
Now, you also mentioned in the report that the so-called Gen Z and millennial cohort are reshaping the vehicle financing market. I'm interested to know what their preferences are and how they're doing that.
That is a very interesting one for us, and I'm glad that you've picked that up. So the Gen Zs are financing vehicles. The previous quarter, they were at 7.9%. And on quarter two, 2024, that increased to 10.9% of their share of the total vehicles that are financed in South Africa. Now, that is a big jump, and it pretty much shows you the influence and where the generational shift is going to. But on top of that, the millennials still take a significant amount of the market at 40%. So between Gen Zs and millennials, 60% of all vehicles finance falls within those two generations. And what has happened here? Opportunities, these Gen Zs who are very tech savvy, who want agility, who will use technology when transacting, they pretty much lean and influence alternatives from traditional vehicle ownership to subscription-based ownership, to pay as you ride vehicles. I mean, I landed in Cape Town yesterday, and the demarcated area at Cape Town International Airport for e-hailing was swamped with people waiting for Ubers. But when I looked at the dynamic, it was all young people. Mm. I was probably one of very few old people. So the financing landscape that you're talking about is very much bolstered towards what is the alternative of vehicle ownership out of the traditional vehicle ownership, and how do we then bolster the economy with the trends that we pick up with these alternatives?
And Marcia, just for the record, you don't sound very old to me, so just be kind to yourself.
You're far too kind. Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you.
Let's move on to electric vehicles. Let me mix metaphors here. Gradually gaining traction in South Africa. I guess that same cohort, Gen Z and millennials, are interested. But as I also mentioned earlier, a very slow take up here.
Very slow take up. But this is where the world is moving to, Jeremy. So this is where we see opportunity as well in terms of the opportunities that lie within automotive. Our Q2 report, vehicle pricing index report, really talks to the slow uptake, but we are seeing an increasing adoption. You know, at a point in time, electric vehicles only consumed 1% of the market. But from the previous quarter to this one, we've seen a 5% increase in both EVs and hybrid vehicles by quarter to 2024. So what does that mean in vehicle numbers? Because sometimes the percentages give us a different view. We are moving off a base of 1,000 vehicles to 4,122 vehicles by quarter to 2024. You can see where the trajectory is going to. But like you said earlier, people are anxious. People have range anxiety. And it's all about what do we do as the automotive industry to educate the public. But we also have to deal with things like challenges like affordability, infrastructure development around these, and improvements in battery technology. But this is where we are gravitating to. And the Gen Zs, absolutely environmentally conscious. And these are some of the questions our data talks to. The first thing that they would ask for is, what is the emissions of this vehicle, which just tells you how conscious they are.
That's interesting. I mean, if I draw a comparison, when I bought my first car, I was more interested, in the color and how fast it could go. But how things have changed. Yeah, still not sure if I'm going to try that electric vehicle, but nonetheless, a very interesting conversation. Marcia Mayaba from TransUnion South Africa, thank you so much for talking to me tonight. And that's our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.